Good morning all and welcome to the September Alpha Teleclass Influenza Preseason Update. That might be a little bit optimistic. I've heard reports on the news of Influenza A out there already. On behalf of the Association of Local Public Health Agencies, I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. Our faculty is Dr. Teresa Tam. Dr. Tam heads up the Immunization and Respiratory Infections Division of the Center for Infectious Disease Prevention and Control at Health Canada. If you are ever able to get in touch with Dr. Tam at her office, she will have just been back from a conference in some distant part of the world or just about to leave for a meeting somewhere. She has boundless energy and she is always in motion and she's such a nice person. And she's a very popular person to speak at conferences. She's pretty popular with me, too. I think this is her third teleclass lecture. To bring us the teleclass, Influenza, a Preseason Update from Health Canada, it is my pleasure once again to introduce Dr. Teresa Tam. Dr. Tam.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to this audience again for the third teleclass that I've done. So again, the primary objective of this class is to provide everyone with a summary review of the key influenza activities or issues before you begin this next winter season. So on slide number two, there is an outline of what the key areas are that we're going to be looking at. I'm going to start with a highlight of what happened in the last influenza season in Canada and worldwide. And, of course, there's numerous really interesting influenza-related outbreaks around the world. So I'm going to touch upon the avian influenza outbreak, H5N1 in Asia, as well as our very own domestic outbreak of H7N3 in poultry in British Columbia. I will very briefly go over the new National Advisory Committee on Immunizations recommendations for the year 2004-05, the coming season. I'll also provide a brief update of what's happening with the Canadian Pandemic Influenza Plan. And so if we turn onto our first subject, really on page four, this is a recap of what happened last year. So influenza in Canada at the national level, as you probably all know, is coordinated through the Flu Watch program at Health Canada. And this consists of three components, a laboratory network for surveillance, a network of sentinel physicians in provinces and territories, and in collaboration with the College of Family Physicians of Canada. And thirdly, the provincial territorial reporting of activity levels. We also added in a pilot for looking at influenza hospitalizations in children in the last season. So really worldwide, influenza A, H3N2 predominated. There were some reports of co-circulations of influenza A, H1, and influenza B viruses. In Canada, we can briefly characterize the season as being relatively early and relatively severe compared to the preceding three seasons, although the indicators that we follow shows that the severity is within what we've seen in previous years, such as the A Sydney year. Again, in Canada, as in the rest of the world, influenza A, H3N2 predominated. There was certainly interest in potentially an observation for increased number of pediatric deaths worldwide. And the first reports that piqued our attention came from the United Kingdom of a cluster of a few pediatric deaths. The United States also was concerned when they began to receive some reports, and they actually actively asked all their physicians to report pediatric mortality for the past season. And in Canada, we really haven't collected pediatric death data in any systematic way in the past, but we did ask provinces and the territories to passively report any pediatric deaths that they heard about to us. In addition, we also set up the impact hospital surveillance system very rapidly for that season. So it's very difficult to know, in fact, whether this new influenza AH3N2 strain called A-Fu-Gen had a more severe impact on children because we couldn't really compare it to past data. In the United States, they've reported in the MMWR, as of May the 31st, 152 deaths with laboratory confirmed influenza in people under the 18 years of age. In Canada, through our passive reporting system, we received only 4 reports of laboratory confirmed influenza-related deaths in children between the age of 7 to 14 years. 3 out of the 4 had an underlying medical condition, and 3 had received partial or full influenza immunizations. In terms of the impact network, we had it's difficult to try and figure out the potential overlap reporting between the passive and the impact network systems, but we feel that there's probably an additional 3 deaths that were reported through the impact network. On the next few slides, we're now on slide number 5. I'm going to just briefly go over some of the indicators that we use to monitor the influenza season. And the first one shows, as a single asterisk, when provinces and territories began to report laboratory-confirmed influenza, and the 2 asterisk shows the peak of the influenza activity. So it was a relatively early season with Alberta and Saskatchewan reporting some first isolations in late September, early October, and in these provinces, the peak of laboratory positive isolates occurred in November. The majority of the other provinces began reporting isolations in November with peaks somewhere between December to February. Ontario, of course, affects a lot of our national indicators because of its size and population. So note that Ontario, Manitoba, and BC all peaked in terms of their activities in December. And so then the next few slides, slides 6 to 8, I believe, shows the key indicators as we track them throughout the season. And of note, then, the overall trend is for the activity beginning in October, peaking in week 52. So we just very quickly then go through the next slide, slide number 6. We received over 65,000 tests for influenza reported through Health Canada's lab network. Approximately 17% were positive. The peak in isolation at week 52, the last week of the year, was at 31% positive rates, which is very high. In fact, it's higher than a lot our previous 4 seasons. The next slide, slide number 7, shows the Sentinel Physician Network's reporting of influenza-like illnesses. Again, the indicator is within the range observed for the preceding 7 seasons, but it peaked at week 52 with a rate of 79 influenza-like illnesses per 1,000 patient visits. The next slide, slide number 8, shows the provincial and territorial reporting of activity levels, and the red bars show when provinces reported widespread activity in their reporting regions. And so this began in the first week of November and peaked in week 52 as well. So as you can see, all of our indicators trend very nicely with each other. Slide number 9 shows the strains that were characterized during the last season. Provinces send select strains to the National Microbiology Lab in Winnipeg for antigenic and genetic identifications. And influenza AH3N2 predominated. At the very start of the season, if you remember, A Panama-like strains were still being identified. By November, the A-Fu-Gen strains began to be identified. By December, most of the strains were characterized as A-Fu-Gen. And by the end of the season, all of the AH3N2 strains were A-Fu-Gen-like. And this strain is antigenically distinguishable from the vaccine strain contained in last year's trivalent vaccine, which was A-Panama 2007-99. And as you can see, we also have a few other strains identified. The influenza Bs mainly occurred in January. And of the influenza Bs, most of them were B Sichuan-like. There are two influenza B lineages, the B Yamagata and the B Victoria lineage. The predominant B strain last year, B Sichuan, belonged to the B Yamagata lineage. And we didn't have very many H1 identifications. The next slide, slide number 10, summarizes the key findings of the IMPACT hospital network. For those of you who are not familiar with this network, there is a network of pediatric tertiary care hospitals. So we're likely to pick up the most severe end of the spectrum. And out of the the reporting sites, 9 participated in reporting last year. Out of the 9 centers, there were over 500 hospitalizations in children with laboratory-confirmed influenza. So that really points out the significant impact from influenza in kids in Canada. And again, the weekly admissions change over the season, with the peak again occurring at week 52, like all the other indicators. Influenza A was identified in the vast majority of cases. The vast number of children admitted to hospital were very young. 80% were under the age of 6. And the one group that we were particularly interested was the age group 6 to 23 months, for which NACI has had a new vaccine recommendation. So 1/3 of the cases admitted to the IMPACT hospitals were in this age group. Of the children admitted, 1/3 had an underlying medical condition for which annual immunization is recommended. In addition, there's a larger number which had other medical conditions. The average length of hospital stay was approximately 5.2 days, but 60 kids were admitted in the ICU. That's about 12% of this 500 or so kids reported. So this has been a very valuable system for us for monitoring the impact in children, and we will be continuing it this year and expanding it to all the impact sites. So the next area that we're going to be reviewing is the avian influenza outbreaks. And on slide number 12, the slide that's ahead with the heading human infections, human bird flu infections. There is an error in this slide, which I'll point out in a few minutes. Now, since 1959, there had only been, prior to all this happening, about 21 outbreaks of highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreaks reported worldwide. And so one has to wonder, is it just better surveillance and reporting, or are we seeing some sort of true phenomenon in terms of a rise in these outbreaks and also transmission to humans? The key avian outbreak that I'll be focusing on is the H5N1 outbreaks, because they have been associated with severe human infections. And I think we reviewed some of the past outbreaks in the previous teleclasses. H5N1 was first demonstrated to be transmissible humans, resulting in high case fatality rate in Hong Kong in 1997. From 1998 to 2002, avian outbreaks continued in Hong Kong. And the virus continued its evolution genetically and antigenically, with some ominous characteristics developing over these four years. And one of the key observations initially was that it became lethal to wild birds, so that wild birds in Hong Kong parks, for example, were dying off. The year 2003 was significant in that these were then the first new human cases of H5N1 re-emerging. And many people remember this family cluster where 2 and probably 3 cases in this family traveled to the Fujian province in China from Hong Kong in February. And so 2 out of the 3 people who were sick were identified to have confirmed to have H5N1, and two out of the three died. And in December 2003, we began to have the first H5N1 outbreak reported in poultry in South Korea. And thereafter, a very large ongoing Asian epizootic, that is an epidemic happening in animal populations, continued, whereby we have 40 associated human cases. And we'll look at these cases in a little bit more depth, but currently 9 countries have reported H5N1 avian outbreaks, and these included Vietnam beginning in January, followed by Japan, Thailand, China, Laos, Cambodia, Indonesia, and then Malaysia more recently. And of more concerns, that new human cases again being reported in August and September just recently. Of interest, there seems to be a seasonal pattern to avian influenza in Asia that's beginning to sort of come out of the data. And it's potentially we might expect an increase in avian outbreaks in the winter months. So the other types of bird flu that have affected humans included H9N2, so far has been associated with mild disease. The third bullet, there's an error, it shouldn't say H7N7, it should say H7, because there are several strains of H7s that have been associated with human cases. In 2003 in the Netherlands, it was H7N7 with 89 cases and one death. In Canada, in the British Columbia outbreak, it was an H7N3 strain in poultry associated with 2 human cases. And the United States, actually, if we reviewed retrospectively the data, also reported a couple of cases, sporadic cases of H7N2. H7 infections so far have been relatively mild in humans. Next slide is slide number 13, and again summarizes the avian H5N1 situation in Asia and some of the concerning features of this outbreak. Experts don't believe this is an increase in reporting phenomenon, but that there is truly something a bit sinister happening with this H5N1 virus. It's been in Asia since 1996, with the first documented avian-to-human transmission in 1997. But right now we have an enzootic, and that is infection pervasive in the bird population, and an epizootic with these outbreaks of unprecedented size and complexity involving over 9 huge Asian countries. And as I said, the ongoing concern is that we still get human cases reported, and similar to the 1997 Hong Kong situation, these cases are young, healthy people and associated with a high fatality rate of approximately 75%. Now, we may not have documented the full spectrum of H5N1 infection in humans. There are serologic studies being done in some of these countries, but I have not actually seen any of the results. So there could be a milder end of the spectrum, but certainly anyone presenting with severe illness typically has been young, healthy persons. And as scientists monitor the genetics of this virus, it continues to evolve. Fortunately, there's been no sustained human-to-human transmission to date, but we're obviously vigilant. Slide number 14, why are we concerned? We're concerned because of the large number of countries affected, where the ability of the countries to control the progress of spread is uncertain. We also have these human infections in countries where there's limited implementation of protective measures to prevent transmission from bird to humans. In these more tropical countries, human influenza virus co-circulate year-round, so that there's always a risk, potentially, of genetic reassortment if someone's infected with human and avian strains. and the majority of the world's population have no immunity to H5. So all of these ingredients come together could result in what we all fear, which is the next influenza pandemic. I think the good news is that we have the capacity now to monitor the situation very, very closely. The next slide, slide number 15, shows some of the interesting findings of late, that H5N1 has a wider host range than we previously had known. We knew about the domestic poultry outbreaks. We observed the ominous characteristic that this virus can kill wild birds, which normally is the reservoir. And in that little diagram, it shows the wild birds in the middle as the reservoir who are not normally sick from influenza viruses. We then have humans who are affected, our primary concern. We have swine in China that's been reported to have had H5N1 infections. And more recently, in the Netherlands, scientists have infected domestic European cats with this virus and shows that they are susceptible. Some of you may remember there were certainly some sporadic reports of tigers in Thailand being infected with H5N1 in the zoos. So this is cats are not one of the hosts that we normally have monitored influenza in. So another ominous feature. The next slide, slide 16, is can we, based on current abilities of the international community, contain an initial outbreak of novel influenza virus and thereby stopping a development of a pandemic? Can it be done? Well, we know that Hong Kong did accomplish this with some drastic and very expedited animal control measures in 1997. However, the current situation, I think, is more challenging. For the reasons that we've already talked about, together with some of the challenges in terms of international collaborative actions, some countries obviously have less of a capacity to perform surveillance, and there's incomplete reporting of their findings. There's poor public health infrastructure in these countries, and very complex political and economic situations, which don't always facilitate us being able to control these initial outbreaks. So huge concerted international action is required for early identification and reporting, for rapid health, public health action. We need to establish even an international set of concepts of operations and protocols. There must be political will and international support. And some of the supports that we've been discussing at the World Health Organization sort of level is, should we have an international stockpile of antivirals to send to the potential Asian countries where outbreaks occur? We should probably support them with personal protective equipment, which they don't have. Compensation from the international funding agency would certainly help. I'm going to now turn to the situation that we saw in British Columbia with our own domestic outbreak of highly pathogenic avian flu, H7N3. And as this situation evolved, what happened was that initially on a farm, a commercial chicken breeder farm in British Columbia's Fraser Valley, at low pathogenicity, avian influenza H7 was first noted, but around February the 18th or so, there's been increasing concern with further die-offs in this particular farm, so that the CFIA officially reported this outbreak on February the 19th in this one farm, and the farm was immediately quarantined and the birds were depopulated. So it was really March 18th when they confirmed the highly pathogenic avian influenza on this first farm. By March 11th, second farm were affected. Despite the initial targeted control measures, the disease continued to spread to other farms in the Fraser Valley. so that in the end, approximately 19 million birds were depopulated. The spread, the mechanism of spread is under investigation and review, but likely it was spread by the movement of people, equipment, or birds at the very start. The CFIA and other scientists have also investigated the potential for airborne transmission through dust and feathers over shorter distances. The next slide, slide number 13, shows some of the control measures that were implemented, including movement restrictions, the disinfection checkpoints that the CFIA set up. There were legal steps taken for requiring bird owners to prevent unauthorized entry to their properties. And then there was a depopulation program focusing on susceptible birds within 3 kilometers of the infected premises. And a big active surveillance and testing procedure where birds who were tested negative were then slaughtered through the normal commercial channels. So the depopulation activities continued until June the 4th, which was 21 days after the last new report of confirmed avian influenza in the poultry. The outbreak was then declared contained on August the 18th, again 21 days after the last infected premises were cleaned and disinfected. So the next slide, actually I'm losing count, this is slide number 19. The human health issues related to this BC outbreak. As soon as Health Canada heard about this outbreak in poultry, we immediately called the BC CDC. They got together the local health units, implemented active surveillance of the farm and family members, and we also monitored the people involved in the depopulation activities. I think that on the human health side, we worked really, really fast. And the local health unit and the occupational health people were able to identify 2 cases of laboratory-confirmed human H7 infections. They were both people that were involved in culling activities and were CFIA workers. One of them was a hired worker. And fortunately then, with whether it's because of the characteristic of this particular strain or because of the big efforts in terms of the protective measures we implemented, there certainly was no further human cases. There is a serologic study being performed, and so far, certainly for over, I believe, 150 people who were exposed, tested, we have not been able to detect any seroconversion. And so the type of measures that we recommended, including vaccinating at-risk persons with the annual human influenza vaccine to prevent the chance of reassortment, to lower the chance of reassortment, personal protective equipment advice was provided. We also recommended antiviral prophylaxis and treatment. And the Pandemic Influenza Committee's working group on antivirals and other working groups came together, and we drafted a new set of guidelines to guide provinces and territories in managing human health issues related to domestic avian influenza outbreaks. So this Friday we will be going to British Columbia to have a joint Health Canada CFIA debrief of the lessons learned from our experience. So that should further inform our response activities in the future and help us strengthen our pandemic influenza plan and our various guidelines. So I'm going to turn to the next area of our review today, which is the NACI recommendations. These were published in the MMWR on June the 15th, 2004. And what's new, that's slide number 21, are some new vaccine recommendations which we make every year. A new recommendation for the immunization of healthy children 6 to 23 months. We also commented on the immunization of colors involved in depopulating poultry infected with avian flu based on our British Columbia experience. And then included the prophylactic use of the neuraminidase inhibitors. Also, Tamivir had been, during the past year, licensed for prophylaxis. So that's why NACI had included this new recommendation. Slide number 22 shows the vaccine composition of the current season's vaccine. And the H1N1 strain remains the same. That's the A New Caledonian strain. The WHO recommended the Afujian light strain, and the one that's going to be in use in Canada is called A Wyoming 3/2003. A B Shanghai strain was recommended by the WHO, and in Canada, the vaccine companies will be using the B Jiangsu strain, which is the antigenic equivalent strain to B Shanghai. And right now, there's no delays in supplies anticipated in Canada for this season. The recommendation for children, slide 23. The influenza, inactivated influenza vaccine has been licensed for those over 6 months of age for over 20 years in Canada, and has been recommended for those with high-risk conditions in this age group. Ontario, of course, has been using this, vaccinating this population as well as part of its universal immunization program, and any Ontario data would be helpful in terms of looking at the impact of vaccines in this age group. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice in the United States has also provided this recommendation this season. And some of the deliberations of NACI included looking at the risk and benefits. And the committee members felt that kids in this age group are certainly at high risk of influenza-associated hospitalizations compared with older children and young adults. And so that in this year's recommendation, we included them as one of the groups at high risk of influenza-related complications. The rates of hospitalization in kids in this age group are comparable to those identified as being high risk, such as those aged over 65. But the mortality is low in children. So if objective is to prevent death, then the vaccine is probably not going to be very cost-beneficial. We looked at the vaccine effectiveness in this age group, and that was assessed by a limited number of studies, and we're aware that the data is limited. We put all the studies together, probably over less than 1,000 kids in total studied, until a recent publication in MMWR, which I will briefly go over. And so we are aware that ongoing studies are required in this age group for vaccine effectiveness. There were certainly some discussions as to whether children vaccinated, unprimed children that were vaccinated, has any differences in their immunological response to future encounters with the wild virus, and this merits further study. We're also going to be monitoring adverse events in this age group, and there's certainly interest in whether ocular respiratory syndrome, one of the new adverse events observed in the year 2000, usually seen in younger people and more commonly in first-time vaccinees, will this occur in kids in this age group because they are, for the most part, first-time vaccinees. If we look at vaccine effectiveness data from the last season, there was a lot of discussion as to, because last season was a the circulating strain, A. sujan, was not a good match with the vaccine strain, was the vaccine effective? And the initial not very well planned out studies done in a bit of a hurry showed no vaccine effectiveness. Whereas a very recent publication, which I would advise all of you to have a look at in the MMWR August the 13th, showed a couple of the studies in Colorado in the United States. One of these was a retrospective pediatric cohort study, which looked at over 5,000 children in the 6 to 23-month age group. This was done using a electronic medical record and immunization registry linkage of these databases from a large HMO. And they assessed the vaccine effectiveness against attended illnesses. And the outcomes that they looked at was influenza-like illness and pneumonia and influenza, not laboratory-confirmed influenza. And what they found was vaccine effectiveness was only 25% against influenza-like illness, but 49% against pneumonia and influenza as a syndrome. And one would really expect that if they looked at, was able to look at laboratory-confirmed influenza, then the vaccine effectiveness would be higher. An observation of note is that they found that vaccine effectiveness was only observed after two doses in this age group, which supports our current recommendation. Also published in that same MMWR article was an adult case control study in people 50 to 64 years of age. This looked at laboratory-confirmed influenza cases matched with controls recruited through random digit dialing. And in that particular study, the odds ratio was used to calculate vaccine effectiveness. This was estimated at 52% for those without high-risk conditions and 38% for those with high-risk conditions. And the findings from these two studies is not that different from our previous observations, that even in a vaccine mismatch year, there is suboptimal, but there's still some benefit, and that we do continue to recommend vaccination even in a year where there is a vaccine mismatch. There was also a publication from Toronto Public Health in the CCEDR looking at long-term care facilities which had lab-confirmed outbreaks which did not demonstrate vaccine effectiveness. There's certain difficulties with the interpretation in this report in that they only looked at long-term care facilities with outbreaks and did not estimate for us the vaccine effectiveness in the institution without the outbreaks. So it would be interesting to get more data from the long-term care facilities in Ontario this season. So the next new recommendation on slide 24, looks at oseltamivir is now licensed for treatment and prophylaxis. And I think one of the key questions I've been asked just recently is, are you concerned about the development of antiviral resistance? And this really stems from a recent publication from Japan in The Lancet by Kiso and colleagues, where they looked at 50 kids treated with oseltamivir, where they, through a very stringent laboratory technique, showed that 18% of the isolates had resistant genotypes. Japan's one country that uses a lot of antiviral drugs. And so a lot of the question is this going to change any of your recommendations? Is this of concern? Now, of course, any antimicrobial agent must be used with care. We all know that resistance can develop with antivirals. But neuraminidase inhibitors, really on all the data so far, has a much lower risk of resistance development than amantadine or remantadine, for which if you use it for treatment, resistance develops very, very rapidly. The Japanese study is not that out of range with some of the previous observations of about resistant strains in 0.3 to 9% of treated patients. children always seem to have a higher likelihood of developing resistant strains. We have not received any evidence of de novo resistance in this virus, so for oseltamivir. So it's only observed during therapy. And I think that the methodology in the Japanese study is a bit different from what was used or what is being used to look at the strains collected through surveillance efforts globally. The WHO will be analyzing Japanese strains collected through surveillance to look at antiviral resistance over a number of years to give us a bit more data. We don't know, even though these strains have resistant genotypes, we really don't know what the clinical significance of these resistant strains are. We also have little data on the pathogenicity of these strains, the viral shedding ability of these strains, and transmissibility of these strains. I think in Ontario, for certain oseltamivir is now being used in long-term care facilities for outbreak control. So again, it is important to collect relevant information. If you suspect that you observe resistance during oseltamivir usage, then these strains should be sent to the National Laboratory in Winnipeg for resistance testing. So the last part of our talk is going to be focused on the update of the activities concerning pandemic preparedness in Canada. And on slide number 26, it shows our pandemic preparedness milestones, which we have gone over in the past teleclasses. So the real significant development is the actual public release on the Health Canada website of this national plan in February 2004. Although the plan is never going to be, you know, perfect, we felt at that point in time the avian H5 situation was escalating in Asia. We really felt that it was just time to get the document out there and people can give us our comments once they have access to the document. So obviously Health Canada will be pleased to receive any of your comments. And the next slide, slide number 27, again reviews the characteristics of our pandemic plan, which is national in scope. It was done with federal, provincial, territorial, and expert input. It's based on a nationally agreed upon goal of reducing morbidity and mortality and secondarily reducing societal disruption. It's organized into different components, which are tackled by different working groups. And it uses the WHO pandemic phases, which I've been told may be modified soon. I hope the modifications are not huge. I don't think they are, but we'll have to wait and see what the WHO processes are. The key for the plan is identifying roles and responsibilities. And the next slide, slide number 28, shows the kind of strategy that is being employed in our planning processes. So the first strategy is rapidly detecting something happening and monitor its spread done through surveillance and laboratory testing. The next strategy is reducing spread and impact. And we are going to, I'm going to talk about some of the new public health measures being discussed, the sort of non-viral specific public health measures. That's new since the plan was published in February. We have, of course, the vaccine and antiviral strategies and the strategy for maintaining health services and emergency social services. Maintaining public awareness is key, and there was a risk communication meeting, and the national and international experts in Ottawa, I think it was in June, I keep forgetting all these dates, which was very, very helpful, and we hope to be able to develop some really good risk communication guidelines and tools coming out of this meeting. There's a meeting in Singapore right now. Dr. Arlene King is there with our communication folks, where risk communications for pandemic influenza is going to be discussed at the international level. So our current activities focuses on the the following points shown on slide 29 and then slide 30. What I'm going to do is focus on a few key areas I think might be of interest to this audience, and I've highlighted these in yellow. And some of the things that we're doing right now is to look at, in a more detailed manner, our response during that phase zero. That's the pre-pandemic phase. But when novel virus is appearing and when there's avian or other animal outbreaks and there's beginning to be reports of human cases, fleshing out some of the details of what we do during that period. As I said, we actually have approved by the Chief Medical Officer of Health a document, a guideline called the Human Health Issues Related to Domestic Avian Influenza Outbreaks, and we hope to get this posted soon. There's just final approvals to be done. I believe that this was sent out as a draft to the health units in Ontario, and we have no problems with that as long as people know that it hasn't been fully approved. Now, we're also looking at some new annexes. Our plan is a giant plan because it's so full of annexes, and we've got more to come. And these include the First Nations and Inuit Health Branch Annex, looking at how this particular population will be managed during pandemic, the new public health measures, which we'll be discussing in a few minutes, the surveillance annex hasn't actually been drafted for the last plan, so we'll be doing that. Slide number 30, I'll give you a bit of an update about the antiviral strategy, and then finally I'll just sum up some of the research activities. We are going to be exercising bits of the plan in the coming year or two. Slide number 31, that's public health and border measures. And recognizing that at the very start of the pandemic, potentially only virus-specific intervention are limited supplies of antivirals for Canada or for some of the more affluent countries. For some of the less developed countries, they have no virus-specific interventions. They're going to be relying on public health interventions. So the WHO convened a consultation on the 27th of April 2004 on the priority public health interventions before and during an influenza pandemic, and that is published on the WHO website. I won't go into details, but you should certainly access that document. Particularly after SARS, we know that a range of non-medical interventions, from personal hygiene, wearing a mask, to quarantining and screening of travelers, can potentially reduce opportunities from transmission and slow international spread, maybe right at the start of a potential pandemic. I think it was recognized by the experts that once a pandemic gets going, there's efficient human-to-human transmission and it's leaching out beyond an initial focus, then public health interventions are not going to be able to stop a pandemic from developing. However, it may help to slow down the impact and transmission of the pandemic until a vaccine is available. So these were discussed in some detail. The next few slides I've really included just for your, maybe for your reference. I think the international group recognizes there are some fundamental differences between SARS and influenza in terms of the virus's characteristics, such as the incubation period, in the infectious period, transmission routes, the age distribution of the population that may be affected, and the attack rates, which makes influenza much harder disease to control than SARS, potentially, using these public health measures. So I'll leave you guys to look at this at your leisure. The next two slides, the public health measures, the scope of the public health measures that was discussed at the WHO meeting includes tactics to decrease contact. So these include isolation of cases and quarantining of contacts, which can only be feasible right at the start of the pandemic. Once you have got a high attack rate, a large number of cases, you cannot be isolating, doing contact tracing and quarantining people. And quarantine may be done, of course, in different settings, hospitals, home, and even conveyances. There was a lot of discussion about travel restrictions, such as escalating types of travel advice, screening. I think that the expert group favored more of the exit screening from the initial country or area where the first human clusters are being observed, whereas entry screening was felt to be not feasible to try and pick up cases. Of course, travel bans are a potential discussion, but probably very difficult to have agreement and implement. Restricting mixing of populations, this is something that in Canada we will be looking at in our own guidelines, and certainly depending on the age groups affected, school closure is something that is being looked at by the public health. Banning of mass gatherings, avoided crowded places are some of the measures being discussed. Slide number 34 shows some of the measures which may decrease effective contact, and that includes case hygiene, infection control measures, as well as contact hygiene. And it certainly was felt that putting a mask on someone who's an identified case, together with some of the sensible infection control measures, should of course be promoted. People did feel that it would be difficult to do any sort of environmental hygiene of large scales, like in terms of SARS, when in Hong Kong they disinfected buildings and cleaned out ventilation system, which is probably not going to happen for influenza. I'm going to talk a little bit about the antiviral strategy developments, and on slide number 35, we have two different types of antivirals, which had been discussed in the past. Now, why are we considering antivirals in pandemic planning? Now, initially, in keeping with our overall goal, we wanted to use antivirals, especially at the start of a pandemic when vaccine is not available, to reduce impact on morbidity or mortality, also minimizing disruption to our healthcare system. But some of the newer usage of antivirals, including the ones that I've just said, have been focused on minimizing the risk of a pandemic starting at the focus of the novel virus emergence, and also buying time and limiting spread right at the beginning of a pandemic until vaccines become available. We don't really know the impact of antivirals on these situations, and there's certainly a huge amount of scientific work being done with mathematical modeling that I think the results will come out in probably the next 6 months to a year to model the impact of antivirals being utilized for these various indications. Slide number 36, I always want to remind people that why we don't just buy huge amounts of antivirals, because they're not a panacea. They do not answer, or they're not the magic bullet that people think they are. There's certainly very limited global capacity to manufacture them, and they cost a lot of money. But that aside, we don't really know the impact of antivirals in limiting spread at the beginning of a pandemic. Certainly, most data shows that antiviral agents probably don't reduce transmission all that much. But in a family setting, prophylaxis after, in that case, has been identified, of course, is quite effective. The logistics of getting people in to be treated early is a challenge. We really don't have enough data on, are these antivirals going to be effective against serious illness? Some of this data is beginning to emerge for the neuraminidase inhibitors. Their impact on mortality is unknown. Prophylaxis. Could seasonal prophylaxis may be required for 6 weeks or longer? Some of the experts argue for longer. If the virus is around in your community for, a couple of months or 3 months, would you consider giving someone a prophylaxis drug for that long? There's lots of challenges associated with that. Of course, we talked about the antiviral resistance issue. So slide number 37, right now we have looked at some options for the use of these agents and stockpiling, and we'll go into that in a bit more detail. We've in the plan already annexed the guidelines on how to ration the use of antivirals, and we developed some clinical guidelines included in the pandemic plan. Slide number 38. These are the current principles that we're using in looking at our antiviral strategy. We feel certainly that it is of most benefit at the start of pandemic before the vaccine is available. And the priority groups that are developed should be determined for planning purposes. This is important for people to understand that we have to maintain a flexibility to change these based on epidemiology or local needs. And right now, we have hired a contractor to look at these definitions of the priority groups and estimating the size of these priority groups as an exercise that will go on for another few months. Slide number 39. After the scientific recommendations, there has to be the policy considerations. And we're certainly looking at the options for securing a stockpile of oseltamivir. During the Asian avian H5N1 outbreaks, Canada, that is both Health Canada and some of the provinces and territories, did secure a small amount of antiviral agent, which is only enough really for very short-term utilization. We have not agreed upon who is going to fund or how the nationally coordinated stockpile is going to be developed. This is sort of an ongoing discussion. There's agreement that public health and government should control the supply and distribution during a pandemic. The next slide just reminds us of the overall goal, which I won't repeat, but as we look into the next slide, slide 41, the priority groups are all predicated on our goals, on this overall goal. And you've seen some of these this list has changed a little bit since the plan was published. And the main change is that we used to have the treatment groups at the start. We've now inserted the consideration of prophylaxis, that's the PX little abbreviation, of the frontline healthcare workers and key health decision makers ahead of treating high risk in the community. So that's group number 3. That's new. And, of course, there's a big challenge in thinking about what we mean by frontline, and even the key health decision makers takes a lot of reiterations in terms of an agreement on their definitions and their estimates. If you look at group number 7, prophylaxis of essential service workers, initially the policy thinking was maybe we could just do post-exposure prophylaxis. Now, this is not going to be terribly feasible if you're a worker that could be exposed all the time. So I think our technical antivirals group is recommending that we look at seasonal prophylaxis for that 6-week period for a select group of essential service workers. So as a result, we're going to have to do a lot more work in defining this group and estimating their numbers. Next slide, just for your own interest, shows the number of doses that are required for these groups. And that's an important graph for policymakers because they're the people deciding on the money. So some groups are just prohibitively huge and expensive to fund. So slide number 43 shows some of the current policy discussions. These are very draft. What's highlighted in blue are the groups that are currently being considered for funding for the national stockpile, and it's approximately 40 million doses. However, again, we're going to be redefining these groups again and looking at the numbers and the number of doses required. And For the interest of time, I think the next few slides, again, you can peruse in your own time. But slide number 45, looking at our antiviral use during the domestic avian flu outbreaks, is something that we have recommended. And I just want to point out that in the BC avian outbreak situation, we made these recommendations. One of the most challenging pieces of recommendation was the duration of oseltamivir prophylaxis. It's licensed for, well, data is available for its safety for use for 6 weeks maximum. And even though the experts agree that you could probably use oseltamivir for longer, the legal position did not support this. And so we had to make a recommendation that was a bit difficult, I think, for the CFIA in particular, their colors. Well, we're saying you can only prophylax for 6 weeks. Then you're going to have to get these people out of the high-risk exposure situation, give them a two-week drug holiday, and then reinstate the antiviral prophylaxis as needed. So I think that in the interest of time, we'll move on to the very last slide, which is the next steps on influenza research. And right now, we're trying to put together a meeting and coordinate a national research agenda. And we will be putting out a request for proposal for people to submit for funding an evaluation of influenza program, immunization programs, with a primary focus on evaluating Ontario's universal program. We would like to be able to participate in the clinical trials with the H5N1 vaccine. Currently, we still don't have funding. We will be doing an influenza vaccine coverage survey in the early part of 2005, and we are currently looking at protocols for some ongoing vaccine effectiveness studies that we can do on a season-by-season basis, and this year we're probably going to try and focus on the 6 to 23-month age group. That's the end of the presentations.
Well, Dr. Tam, thank you very much for another excellent presentation. You always pack your teleclasses so full of fantastic information, which is at least one reason why I keep inviting you back. Thank you very much, and thanks to everyone who took the time to listen this morning. Until we meet again, goodbye.